This week on the show, we have from Proxmox to FreeBSD, a story of a migration, FreeBSD at 13, the history and future of the most popular BSD-based OS, using a dedicated administration workstation for Solene's infrastructure, LibreSSL 4.0.0 release, Plasma 6 and KDE, as well as FreeBSD 14 and how well that runs, and Dragonfly is replacing GNU Div, Div 3 and SDiv with BSD versions, and some more in this week's episode of BSD Now. BSD Now, episode 585, Infrastructure Administration Workstation, recorded on the 4th of November, 2024.
This episode of BSD Now is brought to you by Tarsnap. Go to tarsnap.com/BSDnow to find online backup for truly paranoid people. And if you want to support this show in one way or the other, check out our Patreon page at patreon.com/BSDnow. And we thank you in advance for that.
Hi, I'm your host, Benedikt Heuschling. And I'm alone this week. Jason and Tom are getting some well-deserved time off, so that's why I'm doing this episode alone. But fear not, I'm not completely alone. I brought headlines, news roundup, and Beastie Bits this week. So we're in good company, I guess. All right, let's look at the headlines for this week. This is an article from no one else than our almost favorite, or one of the favorite ones, IT Notes. This is Stefano Marinelli, and bringing us another nice article titled "From Proxmox to FreeBSD: Story of a Migration." And this starts off with, "I have been managing a client server for several years. I inherited a setup, actually partly done by me at the time, but following the directions of the internal administrator, based on Proxmox. Originally, the VM disks were QCOW2 files, but over time and with Proxmox updates, I managed to create a ZFS pool and move them onto it. For backups, I continued to use Proxmox Backup Server, even though virtualized on Beehive, a solution we've been using for several years. The existing VMs and containers were an LXC container based on Debian with Apache as a reverse proxy. The choice of Apache was mainly tied to specific configurations from the company that produces the underlying software. It has always done an excellent job. Next is a VM running OpenSense. The choice was related to direct use by the client, as it allows easy creation and modification of users for the internal VPN. Some users can access via VPN, OpenVPN in this case, and perform specific operations, such as SSH connections. It has always worked well and is up to date. The two VMs based on Rocky Linux 9, both with components of the management software in Java, with the reverse proxy directing requests based on the requested site. And two VMs based on Rocky Linux 8, these also have parts of the management software and the databases. These machines are used both by providing specific URLs and by the other two as databases." Okay, so that's our setup that we're dealing with. "And the load is not particularly high," Stefano writes, "and the machines have good performance. Suddenly, however, I received a notification. One of the NVMe drives died abruptly, and the server rebooted. ZFS did its job and everything remains sufficiently secure, but since it's a leased server and already several years old, I spoke with the client and proposed getting more recent hardware and redoing the setup based on a FreeBSD host." Okay, and he has links to his other articles that we've covered on the show, and as well as his EuroBSD con talk. So you can read those if you haven't yet. "Unfortunately, I cannot change the setup of DVMs. In my opinion, there are no contraindications since the databases are Postgres and the management applications are Java applications with Tomcat. However, the software house only certifies the type of setup, and considering they're the ones performing updates and fixes, it's appropriate to maintain the setup they suggest. It's a technically sound choice in my opinion, so I can't say anything negative." Okay, then next is the acquiring of new hardware part. "The first step was, of course, to get the new server. It took a few days because I requested ECC RAM for a small price variation and the time extended. As soon as the physical server was ready, I got to work." All right, "I installed FreeBSD 14.1 release root on ZFS, creating a mirror setup between it and NVMe drives. The IO is not particularly heavy in this setup, but I don't want to waste potential. Even if I can reduce the length of operations by a few seconds, I see no reason not to do it. As the first step, I decided to manually create the bridge to which I will connect both the VMs and the reverse proxy, which will be installed inside of the FreeBSD jail. Beehive is in use here, VM Beehive in particular. Tool I use to manage VMs allows creating bridges, but I prefer to manage it manually and maintain more complete control over everything. I will also enable PF. I decided to use Zstandard as the compression algorithm and disable ATIME, so that's ZFS set options, compression to Zstandard as mentioned on Zroot, and the same with ATIME equals off. I then modified etcrc.conf and added a cloned interface, bridge 0, LO1, then named that LO1 Bastille 0 and gave that an IP address and a netmask, so nothing surprising here. Enables gateway, PF enabled, and also Bastille as well. So then updated FreeBSD by running the usual commands, FreeBSD update fetch install, all fine and good to get the latest security and errata notices. I configured the firewall with a basic setup, so this is, he provides the full PF conf, so there is the usual Bastille configuration to do the NUT for the jails, and the Nginx proxy to the jails, as well as OpenSense. And there is the usual, you know, block in all and anti-spoof, and then allowing particular protocols out to the world, or in, actually. Once finished, I rebooted everything to load the new kernel. No problems. Installing necessary tools, and then installed some useful packages. So what is in there? We have tmux, we have ZFS auto backup, mbuffer, rsync, VM Beehive Devel, the development version, okay, EDK2 Beehive and Grub2 Beehive, as well as Bastille. Okay, I created datasets for the jails and VMs, so that's ZFS create zroot slash Bastille and zroot slash VMs. I then started configuring everything. First, Bastille BST. He modified the Bastille conf in user local etc Bastille and added Bastille ZFS enable equals yes, and then the name of his pool in the Bastille ZFS pool option, which we just created, which was zpool, zroot Bastille. Then I enabled and configured VM Beehive, enabling the serial console on tmux. Okay, so that you have a nice way of attaching and detaching to virtual machines. And all the commands are provided, so that you can find on the show notes and where we link to Stefano's article. Now he bootstrapped FreeBSD 14.1 release on Bastille BSD, which is just Bastille bootstrap, then the release version and update to also get errata updates in the jails. Setting up the reverse proxy jail, so that is basically a one run of Bastille create minus B. He named it Apache, used the 14.1 release, gave it an IP address, slash 24, on the bridge 0. Once created, he had to modify the default gateway of the jail because by default it's set to that of the host. It was enough to set the gateway name in user locally. Bastille slash jail slash Apache slash root slash etc slash archie.conf. Yeah, you dig down very deep into individual jail names until you have their actual files. Okay, the configuration of Apache will not be described here as it's closely dependent on the setup, but this jail can reach in bridge mode all the VMs that will be placed on the same bridge. Okay, migrating the VMs. For migrating the VMs, he decided to proceed as follows. First, updating the operating systems of the original VMs to have a latest version of the kernel and all user land. Then creating templates of the VMs with VM Beehive. Snapshotting the VM disks and initial transfer to the new server with the VMs still running. Then, after snapshotting the VM disks, we are shutting down all the source VMs. Hopefully, they're also secure. Creating a new snapshot is next, and performing an incremental transfer and adjusting configurations and changing DNS. So he did the updates via DNF and the Rocky Linux jails, all looking good. He provided the actual kernel versions, but that's not too interesting to this kind of article. And then he migrated Rocky Linux 810 VMs. On the destination server, he created the VMs. He used the Linux-zwol template, then modified the configurations, and he provides complete command line. So what does this do? It sets a 1 gig size disk. Oh, that's sound That looks small to me, but okay. 8 gigs of memory, 4 CPUs, and called it VM100. So we have this VM. He created a virtual disk of 1 gigabyte. Ah, here's the explanation. Because it will be replaced by the dataset sent from the current production server. Ah, so it's a fictitious size. At that point, he deleted the zVol and performed an initial snapshot of the source VMs. Ah, clever. Then he does the big ZFS send. Pipe to mBuffer, pipe to SSH on the remote machine. So we have a nice secure SSH channel, one side sending, the other one receiving DVM from the original source. At the end of the copy, you can do a test and try to boot. What a rocky Linux, 810 VMs, I had no problems because the slash boot partition is in ext4. He then configured the VM as follows, running the command vmconfigure vm100. So then he now gave it 8 CPUs, 12 gigs of memory, set the network adapters, set the disk to a sparse zVol, and then set the MAC address, because I guess that's a fixed one they need, and then the grub run 0 and grub 1 lines to also let the machine know from where to boot. All I needed to do was pass the grub names of the kernel and the init rumfs. It is now possible to start a machine and do a test and connect to the console using vmstart vm100 and vmconsole vm100, respectively. In theory, the machine should boot correctly. It will probably be necessary to change the network interface configurations, but in his case, even keeping the virtio and the MAC address, it changed from ENS18 to ENP0S5, but everything else should be fine. All right, that sounds like a migration or partially successful, and in this case we're not done yet. So at this point the source VM was turned off, not reachable, or simply there is nothing new to synchronize. The migration is complete. Here we go. Otherwise it will be necessary to shut down the source VM, create a new snapshot and transfer it. Let's start by shutting down the source VM and destination one. So VM stop VM100, roll back to the snapshot, transfer to the destination server, create a new snapshot, and then perform an incremental transfer. So he provides the commands for that. Then he continues with migrating Rocky Linux 9.4 VMs. That is a bit special because they use XFS. The partitions are all in XFS, and for some reason, the grub launched by Beehive cannot read from XFS. Therefore, I had to proceed differently. So he copied using rsync the slash boot of the original VPS in ZFS to a directory of the FreeBSD server. Specifically on the VPS, he ran the command, he provides the full rsync command, from slash boot to root at freebsdhost /temp. In this way, he kept the files available. He shut down the machine and the original server and copied the zVol to the new freebsdhost using the same method as the others. At that point, he created the slash boot partition and of the VPS in ext3 directly from the FreeBSD host, providing all the necessary commands as well. Same is true then also for the VM Beehive configuration of this VM, providing it a bit more memory and the usual grub run 0 and grub 1 as mentioned above. So launching the machine, however, it will hang during boot and after a timeout will ask for administrator credentials to enter a recovery shell. This is because the block ID of the slash boot partition has changed and the FS tab of the VM still reports the data of the old XFS partition. That is not ideal, having this hard-coded. In this case, he used the block ID command in the VM and copied the UID to the new partition, then modified FS tab in etc of the VM and put the new block ID there, as well as changing XFS to ext3. After a reboot, the system should start without problems, again with a network card to reconfigure. This procedure worked correctly for all VMs. In this way, the storage remains on virtual block, even if it would be optimal for the drive to be changed to NVMe. And you make this change, you need to enter the VM, create a file etc dracut.conf.d and then 00-custom.conf, where you add the drivers plus equals NVMe with spaces in front and after. And regenerate the init rumfs. In this way, the NVMe driver will be supported at boot. Very nice. Okay, so this is something Linux, Rocky Linux specific, and for those who run those or have migrated, it's good to have this noted down. Then configuring the automatic VM startup. To ensure that all VMs start or boot, just add them to rc.conf as follows, giving a 15-second delay between one VM and another. So he did VM underscore enable, and the VM dir is already listed. And then he does a big VM underscore list and lists the VM separated by spaces, and then VM underscore delay 15. Okay, setting up backups. Yes, don't forget those. At this point, I configured external backups every hour, similarly how he described in a previous article. I like how he thinks, he links everything so that we can nicely jump from one to the other. I also added a local snapshot every 15 minutes, always using ZFS auto backup. And he created a new tag, ZFS set auto backup colon local snap equals true. So that's how they do it. And then the pool name. Then he created a cron tab entry to run this periodically. And that is one way to do that. You can also use other solutions for auto snapshotting, like the ones we've covered on previous episodes. Conclusion. The migration is complete. After changing the DNS, the client performed some tests and everything works properly. Great. It's always good to see when the clients are happy after such a migration and everything is back as they are used to. The setup has been active for over a week and there have been no issues. The performance is excellent. I did not perform tests compared to the previous setup since the hardware of the new FreeBSD host is more powerful and modern, so it wouldn't make sense. Apart from the server or from the manager, no user was informed of the change, and in the last week no reports have been received. The VMs are stable and the host's load is very low. The operation actually took less than 2 hours in total. Most of the time has been consumed by the send and receive operations and gave excellent results. The alternative would have been to install Proxmox on a new host and move the VMs. I probably would have saved a few minutes, but now I can use Beehive, as well as the simplicity and power of the underlying FreeBSD. Excellent. Isn't that a nice migration story? Thank you, Stefano, for yet another write-up, also for providing all the configuration parts so that we can compare with our own notes, and if we're in a similar situation, have a much easier time finding the information. Okay, that's next in our headlines. FreeBSD 13, the history and future of the most popular BSD-based OS. That's a bit presumptuous, but hey, this is from hackaday.com. And goes like the following. Probably not too many people around the world celebrated November 1st, 2023, but on this momentous date, FreeBSD celebrated its 30th birthday. As the first original fork of the first complete and open source Unix operating system, 386BSD, it continues the legacy that the Berkeley Software Distribution /BSD began in 1978 until its final release in 1995. The related NetBSD project saw its beginning somewhat later after this as well, also forking from 386BSD. NetBSD saw its first release a few months before FreeBSD's initial release, but has always followed a different path towards maximum portability, unlike the more generic nature of FreeBSD, which, per their FAQ, seeks to specialize on a limited number of platforms while providing the widest range of features on these platforms. Okay, this means that FreeBSD is equally suitable for servers and workstations and laptops as for desktops and embedded applications, but each platform gets its own support tier level, with the upcoming version 15.x release only providing first tier support for x86_64 and ARCH64, which is based on ARMv8. That said, if you happen to be a billion-dollar company like Sony, you're more than welcome to provide your own FreeBSD support. Sony's PlayStation 3, PlayStation 4, and PlayStation 5, the game consoles are namely all running FreeBSD, along with a range of popular networking and NAS platforms from other big names. Clearly, it's hard to argue with FreeBSD's popularity. Then, despite this, you rarely hear people mentioning that they are running FreeBSD, unlike Linux. So one might wonder whether there's anything keeping FreeBSD from stretching its digital legs on people's daily driver desktop systems. So, in the beginning, there was Unix, is the next chapter in this, once immortalized on the silver screen with the enthusiastically spoken words, "It's a Unix system. I know this." The Unix operating system, trademarked as Unix, originated at Bell Labs, where it initially was only intended for internal use to make writing and running code for systems like the PDP-11 easier. Widespread external use started with version 6, but even before it was the starting point for what came to be known as the Unix-based OSs. Okay, we have a nice diagram showing key Unix and Unix-like operating systems that you can find on Wikipedia, and you can really see how early the BSDs have been around there before other modern-day popular solutions have started. So, and we're still kicking and are alive compared to others that are not around anymore or have merged or somehow disappeared in the mists of history. So that is the overview graphic. And after FreeBSD and NetBSD forked off the 386 BSD code base, both would spawn a few more forks, most notably being OpenBSD, which was forked off NetBSD by Theodore Rad when he was controversially removed from the project. From FreeBSD, forked the Dragonfly BSD project, while FreeBSD is mostly used directly for specific applications such as GhostBSD, providing a pleasant desktop experience with pre-configured desktop and similar amenities, and pfSense for firewall and router applications. Apple's Darwin that underlies OS X and later contains a significant amount of FreeBSD code as well. Overall, FreeBSD is the most commonly used of these OSS BSDs and also the one you're most likely to think of when considering using a BSD other than OS X macOS on a desktop system. And then there's always the question, so why FreeBSD isn't Linux? And the answer here in the article is the Linux kernel is described as Unix-like, as much like Minix. It does not directly derive from any Unix or BSD, but does provide some level of compatibility. A Unix OS, meanwhile, is the entirety of the tools and applications, userland, that accompany it, something which is provided for Linux-based distributions, most commonly known as GNU, which stands for GNU is not Unix, as a lot of people know, project. Ergo, these projects or these Linux distributions are referred to as GNU/Linux-based to denote the use of the Linux kernel and a GNU userland. There's also a version of Debian which uses GNU userland and the FreeBSD kernel called Debian GNU/KFreeBSD alongside a Unix-like Herd kernel-based flavor of Debian, which is Debian GNU/Herd. In terms of overall identity, it's thus much more appropriate to refer to Linux kernel and GNU userland. Features in the context of GNU Linux, which contrasts with the BSD userland that one finds in the BSDs, including modern-day macOS. It is this identity of kernel and userland that most strongly distinguishes these various operating systems and individual distributions. These differences result in a number of distinguished features, such as the kernel-level FreeBSD jail feature that can virtualize a single system into multiple independent ones with very little overhead. This is significantly more secure than a file system-level root jail, which was what Unix originally came with. For other types of virtualization, FreeBSD offers Beehive, which can be contrasted with the kernel-based virtualization machine, KVM, and the Linux kernel. Both of these are hypervisor/virtual machine managers that can run a variety of guest OSs. As demonstrated in a comparison by Jim Salter, between Beehive and KVM, there is significant performance difference, with Beehive NVMe on FreeBSD 13.1 outperforming KVM/Vert.io on Ubuntu 20.204 LTS by a large margin. Ah, and they link also to the article, which is on Clara Systems' website. So that is food for thought for people considering a VM migration. What this demonstrates is why FreeBSD for storage and server solutions is such a popular choice, and likely why Sony picked FreeBSD for its customized PlayStation operating systems, as these gaming consoles rely heavily on virtualization, as with the PS5 hypervisor. Then there's a section on OpenZFS and the NAS thingies. A really popular application of FreeBSD is in network-attached storages, or NAS, with originally FreeNAS, now TrueNAS, running the roots here with iX Systems providing both development and commercial support. Here we saw some recent backlash as iX Systems announced that they will be adding the GNU/Linux-based solution, TrueNAS Scale, while the FreeBSD-based version, TrueNAS Core, will remain stuck on FreeBSD version 13. Here, the register confirmed with iX Systems that this effectively would end TrueNAS on FreeBSD, which wouldn't be so bad if performance on Linux wasn't noticeably worse, as covered earlier, and if OpenZFS on Linux wasn't so problematic. Okay. Unlike with FreeBSD, where the ZFS file system is an integral part of the kernel, ZFS on Linux is more of an afterthought, with a range of different implementations that each have their own issues, impacting performance and stability. This means that TrueNAS on Linux will be less stable, slower, and also use more RAM. Unfortunately, as benefits as open source ecosystem, alternatives exist in the form of Sigma NAS, which was forked from FreeNAS and follows current FreeBSD fairly closely. So what is the big deal with that? Oh, wow, that's kind of a heretic question in these circles, at least. But let's continue. Originally developed by Sun for the Solaris OS, it was released under the open source CDDL license and is the default file system for FreeBSD. Unlike most other file systems, it is both the file system and volume manager, which is why it natively handles features such as RAID snapshots and replication. This also provides it with the self-healing ability, where some degree of data corruption is detected and corrected if enough redundancy is available in the pool, without the need for dedicated RAID controllers or ECC RAM. For anyone who had grief with any of the EXTs, RiserFSs, or other file systems of this world, or journaled or not, which are on Linux, this probably sounds pretty good, and its tight integration to FreeBSD again explains why it's such a popular choice for situations where data integrity, performance, and stability are essential. This is a long article, so they cover also different sections. One about FreeBSD as a desktop, doing some software porting. So here they mention FreeBSD ports and packages, as well as the last part of this article, which is FreeBSD is here to stay. That goes, I'll be the first to admit that none of the BSDs really were much of a blip on the radar of the author of the time when he was spending time with various OSs. Of course, they got lured into GNU Linux with the vapid declarations of the year of the Linux desktop back in the late 90s, but FreeBSD seems to always have been that thing for servers. It might have been just my fascination with porting projects like Nymphcast to other platforms that got me started with FreeBSD as a few years ago, but the more you look into what it can do and its differences with other OSs, the more you begin to appreciate how it's a whole well-rounded package. At one point in time, he made the terrible mistake of reading the Linux from scratch guide, which just reinforced how harrowingly pieced together Linux distributions are. Compared to the singular code bases of the BSDs, it's almost a miracle that Linux distributions work as well as they do. Another nice thing about FreeBSD is the project structure, with no czar for life, but rather a democratically elected core leadership. In the 30 years anniversary reflection article, this is linked to the FreeBSD journal, which had put out a special issue about just that. In FreeBSD journal, the way the system was created is described, and that's directly linking to Kirk McCusick's article. And this one, well worth reading. One could say that this creates a merit-based system that rewards even newcomers to the project. As a possible disadvantage, however, it does not create nearly the same clickbait-worthy headlines as another Linus Torvalds rant. Sorry. With widespread industry usage of FreeBSD and a strong hobbyist-slash-enthusiast core, it seems fair to say that FreeBSD's future looks brighter than ever. With FreeBSD available for easy installation on a range of SBCs, and running well in virtual machines, this definitely is worth to give it a try. Great. Check out the full article for additional good reasons to try it out. And thanks for the people who did all the research and writing up this article. Okay, next up is the news roundup, and we have here using a dedicated administration workstation for my infrastructure over on the DataSwamp, which means we have another article by Selene. She has given us a table of contents for the article, but we can skip that and start with the introduction as always. And she writes, as I moved in my infrastructure to a whole new architecture, I decided to only expose critical accesses to dedicated administration systems. I have just one. That workstation is dedicated to my infrastructure administration. It can only connect to my servers over a VPN and cannot reach the internet. This blog post explains why I'm doing this and gives a high-level overview of the setup. Implementation details are not fascinating, as it only requires basics, firewalling, HTTP proxying, and VPN configuration. Okay. First, after the introduction, is the need. I wanted to have my regular computer not being able to handle my or any administrative tasks. So I have a computer like a regular person without SSH keys, VPN, and a password manager that does not mix personal credentials and administration credentials. To prevent credentials leaking or malware risks, it makes sense to uncouple the admin role from the everything else role. So far, I have been using CubesOS, which helped me to do so at the software level, but I wanted to go further. The setup here is, which is a rather quick one and simple explanation of what you have to do in order to set up a dedicated system, she writes, but that is nevertheless good to know. So first is the workstation part. The admin workstation I use is an old laptop. It only needs a web browser, except if you have no internet web services, an SSH client, and being able to connect to a VPN. Almost any OS can do this. Just pick the one you are the most comfortable with, especially with regards to the firewall configuration. The workstation has its own SSH key that is deployed on the servers. It also has its own VPN to the infrastructure core and its own web password manager. Its firewall is configured to block all in and out traffic except the following: UDP traffic to allow WireGuard, HTTP proxy address colon port through WireGuard interfaces, and SSH through WireGuard. The HTTP proxy exposed on the infrastructure has a whitelist to allow some FQDN. I actually want to use the admin workstation for some tasks, like managing my domains through my regular web console. Keeping the list as small as possible is important, so you do not want to start using this workstation for browsing the web or reading emails. On this machine, make sure to configure the system to use the HTTP proxy for updates and installing packages. The difficulty of doing so will vary from an operating system to another. While Debian requires a single file in /etc/app/app.conf.d to configure apt to use the HTTP proxy, OpenBSD needed both HTTP underscore proxy and HTTPS underscore proxy environment variables, but some scripts need to be patched as they do not use the variables. I had to check FW updates, package add, sysupgrade, and syspatch were all working. Ideally, if you can afford it, configure a remote logging on this workstation logs to a central log server, and when available, audit the monitoring important files access and changes in etc could give precious information. Very good. Next is the server part. My SSH servers are only reachable through a VPN. I do not expose it publicly anymore, and I do IP filtering over the VPN, so only the VPN clients that have a use to connect over SSH will be allowed to connect. When I have some web interfaces for services like MinIO, Pi-hole, and the monitoring dashboard, all of that is restricted to the admin workstations only. Sometimes you have the opportunity to separate the admin part by adding a HTTP filter on a /admin URI, or if the service uses a different port for the admin and the services like MinIO. When enabling a new service, you need to think about all the things you can restrict to the admin workstations only. Depending on your infrastructure size and locations, you may want to use dedicated systems for SSH, VPN, HTTP proxy entry points. It is better if it's not shared with important services. Okay, that makes sense. So next up is file exchange. You will need to exchange data to the admin workstation, rarely the other way. I found NNCP to be a good tool for that. You can imagine a lot of different setup, but I recommended picking one that does not require a daemon on the admin workstation. This does not increase the workstation's attack surface. Then also allowing encryption at rest, so you can easily use and deposit systems for the data exchange, and is asynchronous, as a synchronous connection would be potentially dangerous because it establishes a link directly between the sender and receiver. So she has a separate blog post describing secure transfers with NNCP, because that tool wasn't known to me until 5 minutes ago. Need to read that up. Okay. Then her conclusion is, I learned about this method while reading ANSSI, which is French Cybersecurity National Agency papers. While it may sound extreme, it is a good practice I endorse. This gives a use to old second-hand hardware I own, and it provides my infrastructure security while giving me peace of mind. So she links to the ANSSI website, which is in French, but maybe you can translate it using usual services. In addition, if you want to allow some people to work on your infrastructure, maybe you want to set up some infra for an association, you already have the framework to restrict their scope and trace what they do. Of course, the amount of complexity and resources you can throw at this is up to you. You could totally have a single server and lock most of the services behind a VPN and call it a day, or have multiple servers worldwide and use dedicated servers to enter their software-defined network. Last thing, make sure that you can bootstrap into your infrastructure if the only admin workstation is lost or destroyed. Most of the time, you will have a physical or console access that is enough, and make sure the password manager is reachable from the outside for this case. Oh yeah, this is a well-rounded setup, full of good ideas, increasing security, and also recycling old hardware that otherwise just would catch dust. Next up is another good news from OpenBSD. LibreSSL 4.0.0 has been released, and of course Undeadly.org has the information about it. It's of course from the It's Real Crypto Bro department. The LibreSSL project, they write, a closely associated project of the OpenBSD project, has announced the availability of their stable release, LibreSSL 4.0.0, which comes with a number of improvements and a sprinkling of fixes. Okay. So you can find the release announcements, and it goes from Brent Cook writes, we have released LibreSSL 4.0.0, which will be arriving in the LibreSSL directory of your local OpenBSD mirror soon, or I guess by now, when you listen to this episode, it's already there. It's the first stable release for the 4.0.x branch, also available with OpenBSD 7.6. It includes the following change from LibreSSL 3.9.2. The portable change are, they added initial mscripten support in CMake builds. They removed the time GM compatibility layer, since it all used, all users of that were replaced with OpenSSL time GN, and cleaned up the corresponding test harness. MIPS 32 platform is no longer actively supported. Windows support for dates beyond 2038 has been fixed. Yeah, that thing still is around. Internal improvements, cleaned up parts of the conf directory. They also split the parsing and processing of TLS extensions to ensure that extensions called back are called in a predefined order. They also merged some multi-file implementations of ciphers into one or two C files. Plenty of stuff. It's a long, long list. I definitely recommend you check out the full articles if you're interested in the details. And the LibreSSL project continues improvement of the code base to reflect modern, safe programming practices. We welcome feedback and improvements from the product community. Thanks to all of the contributors who helped make this release possible. As you can see, the article closes with a lot of goodies in this one. Yeah, and so most of this work, or a lot of this work, can be supported by donating to the OpenBSD Foundation, which supports work like this and other activities in the OpenBSD ecosystem. So one of this is making sure that LibreSSL gets more support. And hey, everyone benefits from that, right? Because LibreSSL is not just used on OpenBSD, far from it. Plenty other operating systems include that or use it in one way or the other, or as a library in packages. So definitely this is work that is well received. So thanks everyone who is working on that. Next, we have Plasma 6 and FreeBSD 14 in a nice short article, or more like a how-to. This goes, this is from Adrian, okay. So he writes, I just installed a new FreeBSD desktop machine. For this one, I wanted to have KDE Plasma 6, since that's already running on my Linux laptop and gaming machine. And it's time for me to dog food on FreeBSD. Here are some notes. Base install. FreeBSD has a live ISO and a graphical installer. For licensing reasons, it isn't Calamaris, which is GPLv3, so I use the text-based installer. I downloaded a FreeBSD 14.1 memstick image. From boot to reboot into an installed system takes less than 5 minutes, and then you have an old-school Unix system, a login prompt. From there, you log in as root, switch the package repository to latest, then do package install pkg to bootstrap the package manager, package install git and cmake because you're a developer, package install Plasma 6 Plasma, which is an 800 megabyte download. Wow. Package install SDDM because you want a login manager, and last but not least, package install DRM-Kmod because you need a graphics driver. I have an AMD RX 550 video card, cheapest I could get this year, in the machine, so then to set that graphics driver, do sysrc kld_list AMD GPU. Make sure dbus will run as a system service, dbus_enable=yes, running via sysrc. Create a regular user and add them to the video group. then reboot. All right. Then KDE Plasma 6.11 by hand, or X11 by hand. At this point, the system has KDE Plasma 6 installed, but it won't come up. The login manager isn't enabled, for instance. So we need some convenience things from the before times to do a little testing. Installed as automatic, so they are easy to remove later. You do package install dash capital A, xinit or xinit and xterm. As a normal user, create a .xinitrc in your home directory and put this in it. Bin bash as the interpreter line, and then exec user local bin start plasma dash x11. Then make it executable and start x11 like it's 1994. Change mod 755. Why the 5 at the end? For the world and others? Okay. xinitrc on this one and then start x. Voila! KDE Plasma 6. Note that in this state there are no applications besides Xterm and KInfo Center and a handful of other KDE Plasma internal things. There's no configuration applied to the system, and the window manager does not honor Alt-Tab or Alt-F4. Use Control-Q to quit KInfo Center. But X11 is so passé. Let's move on to the future. Anyway, lint by hand. First, let's install some convenience things that will help in debugging. Package install capital A, river, and foot. Okay. Like I wrote 3 years ago about river, it just works. You need the example configuration so that super shift E exists or exits the compositor and window manager. Okay. And super shift enter gets you a terminal window. He started river as a regular user with ck-launch-session river, and that got it working. Okay. Next is KDE Plasma 6 Wayland by hand. Yeah, right. So there was a brief time in 2021 that it worked. Since then, not so much. Certainly not for me, not from the regular ports tree. So this post is a start of, okay, let's give it another shot. I know that Wayland can work on FreeBSD with hardware rendering. That's why that river section is there. Here is a very short script that can launch KDE Plasma 6 with software rendering. The resulting desktop experience is rather slow. Okay, so he provides a shell script to run all the necessary sessions. So the to-do part of this post is figure out why opening DRI/card0 fails when KWin Wayland is not using the software renderer. Okay, then there is KDE Applications 5 and KDE Plasma 6. Yeah, right. Most, maybe even all, of the KDE applications, for instance, Console or KMail, are still KDE Frameworks 5-based. Unfortunately, there are KDE frameworks that have file collisions between versions 5 and 6. As an example, package kf6baloo and kf5baloo both want to install a libbaloo plugin.so. I mentioned the co-instability problem a half a year ago, but we haven't fixed it since. And he has an edit in this part. From a specific date, this is entirely a packaging problem where we could install things to separate prefixes. That hasn't happened because of lack of person time to actually do it and test it. Okay, so it's technically possible. Someone hasn't gotten time yet to do that. Okay, so give that person some love and hope they finished it by now. On this front, I think we're at a chicken and egg place. We would like to switch wholesale to new applications releases and just drop the existing KDE 5 applications, but are so bogged down with other stuff that's not happening. On the Linux side of things, KDE Application 6 are doing fine. All that said, there's a KDE FreeBSD ports development fork with a branch where newer KDE FreeBSD packages are prepared that already has a KF6-based KMail. So to do part of this section is, I need to double check what's holding it up. Takeaways, for a nice KDE 6 plasma experience on a BSD, why not try OpenBSD? Nice. KDE FreeBSD has a nasty amount of hardware testing to do, and the future is here, just not in the port stream. Okay, so by the way, thank you, Adrian, for all your work in KDE and FreeBSD things. Much appreciated, even though this sounds a bit pessimistic. This is just a snapshot in time, and I guess the work you and other people are doing are giving us the same shininess as other systems have with KDE. All right, we are getting another item here in our news roundup, which is Git World replace new GNU Div 3 and SDiv with BSD versions. And this is on the Dragonfly BSD list. Okay, Matthew Dillon there writes, world. Replace GNU Div, Div3, and SDiv with BSD versions. So they replace Div and Div3 with the OpenBSD Div and Div3, replace SDiv with the FreeBSD SDiv, and remove the GNU Div, Div3, and SDiv tools. Okay, cool. Basic testing with decent bulk to ensure no significant compatibility disruptions. All right, cool. And of course, this is the whole commit and the changes that were made. So it's nice to see that activity is reported, or someone who has submitted this from Dragonfly BSD, and that they are also working on replacing the GNU parts that are still in the system. Okay. BSD bits this week are basically, we found a YouTube video that explains how to upgrade FreeBSD KDE 5 to KDE 6, and that walks you through it, and we thought this would be nice to include in this part. We have no other BSD bits this week, so if you have something that is small or a bit longer, then this would end up in news roundup or even headlines, depending on the newsworthiness or the actuality or the relevance. We would like to get this info to feedback at bsdnow.tv, which is the way how you can reach this show and submit articles, patches, if you have them, questions, show ideas, comments, anything that is on your mind regarding the episode, a particular one, or the whole show as a thing. And if you want to chat with other people that are listening to this show, I guess they do, it's one way to do this is via the BSD Now Telegram channel, which is t.me/BSDNow. And we're already over 200 people, but it's not that loud in there in terms of messages being exchanged. So there are questions, there are some discussions sometimes, but sometimes in long stretches also, it's very quiet. So don't think that's giving you a lot of messages to read and things to follow up on. It's fairly civil in there. Or actually, we're also looking at things. So as moderators, we have a way to make order when order is needed, which hasn't happened yet. So hope that stays this way. Also, other ways to support this show is via Patreon. It's patreon.com/bsdnow. And
BSD Now is sponsored by Tarsnap. Everyone needs backups, and Tarsnap ensures that your backups are not only safe, but also secure. Your data is encrypted on your device before being sent to the cloud, so that only you have the ability to read your data. Tarsnap takes your data and works out what data is duplicated so that bandwidth can be saved. It then assembles your data into compressed blocks, encrypts them with your local private key that never leaves your system, and then uploads those encrypted blocks to the cloud. So even if someone is able to obtain your backed up data in the cloud, they will not be able to decrypt it and access your files. Tarsnap is easy to use. If you can use Tar, then you can use Tarsnap. Tarsnap is prepaid, so you never have to worry about an unexpected bill. Tarsnap is fully open source, allowing you to inspect the code to make sure that it does what we say it does. Tarsnap also does bug bounties if you find errors in the code. With clients on all major platforms, there's no excuse to not have good backups. Go to tarsnap.com to learn more.
That is pretty much it, what I have for you this week as a soloist. Next time, I will have moderators again, because that has already been planned, scheduled, and will soon be also delivered. So by the time you listen to next week's episode, you never have thought that I did this alone. But thanks anyway. Have a nice week. Have a good time. Until next time. And, well, this is the place to be. SD. Haven't said that in a while. So here we go. Bye.